The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 483 for Sunday, January 12th, 2014. Welcome to the Mac Observers, Mac Geek Gab, the show where you hear about some of the questions that we answer from you. Wow, I screwed that up. You send in questions, you send in tips, you send in cool stuff found. We answer them, the questions anyway. We share your tips, we share your cool stuff found, and together we all try to learn a little something new each and every time we get together here, back in Durham, New Hampshire. I'm Dave Hamilton.
Yeah, you're a bit quick on the trigger there with the... But anyways, yes, you're back. Welcome back, Dave.
Thank you, my friend.
And you'll probably tell us where you've been. And here in Fairfield, Connecticut, this is John F. Braun.
That's right. So we finished the last show right before I left for the airport. And I did wind up spending the night in Chicago, but it was, believe it or not, not, at least according to the airline, due to weather. They said it was due to some computer system that United had. They were putting something online to deal with the new crew rest requirements. I think this is kind of how it was explained to me. And the putting the system online that Friday, for whatever reason, caused a third of their fleet to be grounded for like 3 hours. So that caused me to miss my connection. But because it was the airline's fault and not the weather's fault, they put me up in a hotel room, so I got to hang out with Mac Geek Gab listener Barry, and then I went back to the airport. He came and picked me up, actually, at the airport, and then we went and had a couple of drinks, and then I went to my hotel, and then I went back to the airport in the morning and made it to Vegas for New Media Expo and for then CES right after that.
CES.
Yeah. So I ranted a bit about CES, and we'll talk about some of the things I found there, but in a general sense, the plan that I went into CES with this year worked flawlessly, nearly. Well, it was the most productive CES that I've ever had. The more planning you put in to that show, the better, the more you get out of it. I planned a lot of meetings. I didn't spend a lot of aimless time on the show floor because it's just too expansive. I did a little bit, and we'll talk about some of the stuff that that I found. But for the most part, it was actually quite great. So. I'm pretty stoked about it. Let's get into the show, and then throughout the show we'll talk about some of the stuff that I saw at CES and New Media Expo, which was also an excellent show. Really, really good. You got to go to that one, man. It just being a podcaster, it's a great show. There's a lot of good sessions that I saw. I actually participated in what I think was probably the best session of the week, or the weekend. But you know that goes without.
Yeah, well, that's the one that you were part of.
That's correct. That's right.
Yeah. Which was, I think, something along the lines of, let's turn that down, along the lines of how to make a good podcast, right?
A good sounding podcast, yeah.
Good sounding.
Right. Which we had our own little struggles with here for the last 20 minutes. So let's get the show on the road. The first thing I want to talk about is our sponsor for this show, which is Gazelle. Gazelle is, put simply, the place where you're going to go to sell your old Apple products, be it computers or iPads or iPhones. If it's time to upgrade and you don't have someone to just gift your old Apple electronic to, check out Gazelle. It's really simple. You visit gazelle.com and tell them what you have, and they'll tell you what the price is. And this, you can get that done almost as quickly as I explained it to you. It's super easy. You don't need to create an account first or anything like that. You just go. And from the moment you hit their homepage, you're already moving along. You tell them, you kind of narrow down the device. It's, you know, is it an iPad, an iPhone, etc. And then what kind and how big, and done. Then they're going to give you a price based on the your description of the condition, and they help you narrow that down and give you some guidance on it. Then they send you a box free of charge to you. You ship it back to them free of charge to you. You fill out, or they evaluate it, make sure it matches what you said, that you actually sent them a 16 gig, you know, iPad as opposed to a 32 gig. And if you did send them the 32, they're going to shoot you an email and say, hey man, you sent us something different. or the conditions different, we're going to pay you less or more. And in the case of, you know, you sending them a 32 versus a 16, they're going to tell you they're going to pay you more. And we've heard from you folks that they have done exactly that, both based on condition and specs. So then once if they agree with what you sent them, then they just send you money. There's no more back and forth. If there's a disagreement, like I said, they'll let you know, and then you get to pick. Do I want my stuff back again free of charge, or do I want the amount of money that they've told me that it's worth? And then they pay your money. So you spend no cash out, and everything's on them, and then they send you cash. It's very, very simple. And they can do it via Amazon gift card if you want, and actually you get a little bit more, or via PayPal, and you just get your flat, you get the amount that you're due. Or I think they'll even cut you a check if you want. So check them out, gazelle.com. They'll ask you through the process where you heard about this. Of course, you're going to tell them you heard about it on Mac Geek Gab. That lets them know that we told you about it. And that's a good thing, because they've been with the show for a while supporting us, and we certainly appreciate that. So that's gazelle.com, and that's where you're going to go. And with that, John, I throw it to you, and you're going to throw it to Paul.
Don't throw things at me, man. Well, unless you warn me first, in which case that's cool.
Right. So anyways, then Paul, we're playing catch. That's right.
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 So Paul wrote in, and you know, this is a great question, because it led me down a path of discovery, and I learned something, Dave, and I think we're all going to learn something here. So here's the question from Paul. He says, "Hi guys, a bit of a strange question I'm hoping you can help with. And it goes like this. I use Pathfinder because it enables me to use colored folders with Mavericks. And it says I've got 271.3 gigabytes available on my hard drive. When I look in the macOS Finder, it shows I've got 302.25 gigabytes available. When I look in this utility, it says I've got 291.39 available. The question I'm hoping you can help me with is, which one of these is correct and why?" And so that had me scratching my head, Dave. And so I did a bit of research here, and I found what I thought was a probable cause for this. And one reason for this is you may have something called Time Machine Local Snapshots enabled. And there's a dandy Apple support article that goes into this. It's HT4878. Of course, we will link to it. And so what is a local snapshot? And the thing is, Dave, I have not encountered this. The reason being, Dave, is that I use something called Time Machine Editor, which kind of circumvents the normal Time Machine mechanism. And along with that, it disables this thing called local snapshots. So I had never run into this.
I have this on my Air, because I don't use Time Machine Editor on my Air.
You do. All right. So very briefly, so of course people can read the article here, but this is an enhancement that was made, I think, starting in, according to the article, Mountain Lion, or actually Lion.
Yeah.
So normally when you think about Time Machine is a backup that's made from your computer to an external drive. But then they added a little enhancement here called a local snapshot. And it's a little different in that it doesn't make a backup to a Time Machine drive, but it actually makes called a local snapshot to your local drive.
Yeah. And to be fair, it doesn't replace Time Machine. This adds to Time Machine for when you're correct. Not connected to your default backup device. That's right.
Correct. And actually, if you go into the Time Machine interface, so the article says this, but I'm just going to go over the high points here. But if you go into Time Machine, you will be able to tell the difference between the two, because on the screen that shows the different backups that are on your remote Time Machine drive will be kind of reddish purple, I guess, and local backups are going to be shown as gray tabs.
Oh, interesting.
Okay. Now the thing is, I looked, and the thing is, because I again, I'm using Time Machine Editor, which kind of disables Time Machine or does it differently, I never saw these gray tabs. So I wrote back to him. Want to keep the thread here. So I basically wrote back and I said, well, maybe having this local snapshot could account for the difference.
Sure.
And I said, do you see anything in the backups category? And the answer here is that if you go into, about this Mac.
From the Apple menu.
from the Apple menu, more info, and you go to the storage category, you're going to see, looking at your hard drive, you're going to see a number of categories here. And I'm looking right now on my Mac Mini, and I see audio, movies, photo, app, backups. Now, until I enabled this thing, that backups category always had 0 gigabytes in it. But once I enabled this feature, so I'm getting a bit ahead of myself here, but I asked them, could that be it? And he wrote back and said, thanks, John. That's the kitty. K-I-D-D-Y.
I like it.
I think he's from across the pond there, because he also spelled something oddly. Or at least something, he spelled something that was not the way that I would spell it. But he said, that was it. It shows that I've got 13 gigabytes of backups on my SSD. And then he said, I remember in Snow Lion, okay, I think he means Snow Leopard, I disabled these, but I can't seem to remember if there's an option to do this in Mavericks.
Mountain Lion is what he meant. Yeah, but yes. That's okay.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think he said he disabled it. He said, do you know if there's an option to do this in Mavericks? He said he did a DuckDuckGo search. Apparently, he doesn't like Google. DuckDuckGo is apparently an alternative search engine.
Very anonymous, from what I've
heard.
Okay. I think so. Yeah. But anyway, okay. Go ahead. Yeah.
And he said there was some mention of a terminal command, but thought I'd check with you first to see if you knew of a way of disabling these in the GUI. Also, do you know if I can delete this backup? And the answer is yes. I did some further research, Dave. And so there are ways to do this. So from the terminal, and I did this because I wanted to enable these, Dave, because it sounds like a handy thing, because I typically on both my drives have a lot of extra space. And the more backups, the better, as we've discussed in the past. You know, you can never have too many backups.
Sure. Well,
You could. I don't think you could. No, I mean, if you have the disk space, hey, you know, make as many backups as you can.
Sure.
Now, if you want to disable these, which is what he was asking, so that's the first thing I'm going to talk about here. What you want to do is you want to go into the terminal and you want to type in sudo space tmutil, which I'm going to guess is time machine utility, and then space disable local.
And there's not I don't have my air with me, John, but there's not a checkbox in system preferences to turn that off. I swear that there was.
Not.
Laptops.
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. It would only show up on laptops, not on your desktop, you know, Mac Mini, iMac, etc. But I could have sworn it was in, you know, system preferences, time machine options, but I don't have my air with me. So I could be very, very wrong. And I could have dreamt this. So.
Well, hold I'll look briefly here. Let me look on my portable. Well, no, but I enable it on both my machines, Dave, not just the. Options. Let me look here. I don't see anything here.
Even on your MacBook Pro.
Correct. Running okay. Mavericks. So yeah. I don't see any way through the GUI to do this. So
fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah.
So the only way I know to do this. So again, I answered this question and said, if you want to do it in the terminal, you do what I just said. There's a couple other things you could do. If you want to take a single snapshot, you can say tmutil space snapshot. And that's the first thing I did to just prove to myself that this feature works. And once I did that and I went back to this category in the system info, it then showed me that there was data in this backups category.
Yeah.
And then in my case, I wanted to enable it, to experiment with it. And so far, I think I'm going to leave it enabled. Now, again, in my case, because I'm using Time Machine Editor, this was the only way I could really enable it. Maybe there's another way. If people know, let us know. But the way you would enable it is you would type sudo space tmutil space enable local.
Makes sense. I'll buy that.
So I'm in kind of a weird situation in that, again, I'm circumventing Time Machine because technically in the Time Machine utility, it says it still says it's off, but I was able to enable this feature. So I got the best of both worlds.
You're circumventing Time Machine because you've used Time Machine Editor to alter, to create your own Time Machine schedule.
Correct, because if I go into Time Machine on both of my machines, because I use Time Machine Editor, it shows the little slider, it shows it's off.
Right.
But it's really not.
Right.
Because Time Machine Editor is taking care of scheduling these.
Interesting.
And the thing I noticed, Dave, is once I enabled this local feature, the icon in the menu bar changed from gray to not gray.
Ah.
And it is now a solid black. So it's kind of hinting at the fact that, okay, you've enabled some native time machine functionality.
Huh.
Because, yeah, at first I was like, oh, that's different. Yeah. So that answers the question. And the thing is, they even say in the article, at the very end of the article here, just so, you know, people don't worry about this. So number one, you could say, and, you know, we kind of had a theme here going when we were talking pre-show, that sometimes your computer lies to you.
Yeah.
But they say at the very end of the article, they say, note, you may notice a difference in available space statistics between disutility, finder, and get info. Those differences are expected and can be safely ignored. The finder displays the available space on the disk without accounting for the local snapshots, because local snapshots will surrender their disk space if needed.
Cool.
And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. And it's a great feature that I'd never really been aware of, Dave, but yeah. I think it's a good thing. Again, when you're not connected to your time machine drive, this is a good fallback.
Yeah. It gives you that, the ability to have, versions of files that you've edited and you know, that sort of thing that Time Machine sort of automatically right. provides.
And they advertise this is good for if you accidentally whack a file.
Yes. Yeah. It's not good if your drive dies because it's all stored on the same drive.
Right. But if you whack a file and you accidentally delete a file and you don't have access to your Time Machine volume, then this will save you. So that's it.
So we had a question from Francis, John, that turns into something I'd like to share as a tip. He wrote in and said, I'm having this problem where my computer just grinds to a halt and I can't do any searches and I can't look anything up. And, you know, things are just really, really slow. And it turns out that it was Safari's top sites. So Safari's top sites will preload and show you thumbnails for the websites that you visit most frequently. And if one of those websites causes Safari to malfunction, well, then all of Safari will malfunction because it's going to preload those. And so you can mitigate this in a couple of different ways. One way is to go into Safari in general, and it says Safari preferences in general, and bring down the number of top sites to 6. If you're not using this, you want that number as low as possible. Then you can go and make sure it says new windows open with and insert anything other than top sites here. You could have new windows open with homepage and then also new tabs open with. And you want to make sure that too is set for something other than top sites. If you're using top sites, that's fine. But you've just got to be aware of what you're dealing with in case this runs down. It could be that, you know, top sites is misbehaving. So it wasn't obvious to him, and so I figured it would be good to share. So you can reset the top sites by going to the Safari menu, choose Reset Safari, which has the ... after it, which means you're going to get another dialogue. And then you can check a box that says Reset Top Sites, and that will clear all of that out for you, potentially clearing things up in Safari. So there you go. That's a tip from Francis, because he had to live through it. So hopefully you don't have to, or at least you don't have to live through wondering what it is if you're having trouble loading websites in Safari, but everything else works. So thanks, Francis. You want to take us to Michael, John?
Yeah. Now this one is another one in the thread of your computer is lying to you. Dear John and Dave, Happy New Year. I have a question about maps on OS 10.9.1. Whenever I get directions, the distance comes out in kilometers. I can't for the life of me see where to change this to miles. I know it's a small thing, but having to do the conversion every time is less than convenient. Maps on my iOS devices have miles as a distance. I downloaded a little app called Converto that sits in my menu bar to have access to quick conversions, but it's still a pain. Any help would be appreciated. All right. So I've run into problems like this in the past, Dave. And so number one, I think the United States is the last country in the world that hasn't figured out this metric system thing, which is in and of itself kind of annoying.
Well, yeah, I mean, yes and no, right? I mean, for example, my my scale at the Westin, which is where I stayed during CES, it had a minor measurement of kilograms, which I'm used to seeing on every scale in this country, right? It was an analog scale. It was a mechanical scale. And the main, so I stepped on it and I'm like, that's fine. I looked down, I'm like, what is this thing trying to, what in the stones? It's measuring my weight in stones. And so in England, I believe they use stones and then pounds. A stone is 14 pounds for those of you that didn't know. So, you know, then, and I posted this to Twitter and had quite a few of you from across the pond, as John is wont to say, reply and say, yeah, I only know my weight in stones. They know that they're, you know, whatever, 13 stone, you know, four pounds or whatever. And that's how that goes. So, yeah, it's
wow. They're even more backwards than we are. Wow.
Well, in that sense,
stones.
I know. I couldn't believe it when I'm like, wait a minute. I know it's been a long day, but seriously, like, there's no pounds listed anywhere on here. It's just stones. But it was good. I did the math. So.
I mean, is that like measuring like a horse in hands or that? Never mind. Sorry.
Horses are measured in hands. A hand is four inches.
They are.
A hand is 4 inches. That's right. But see, that's the other thing, right? That comes from England, I believe, measuring a horse in hands. Mm-hmm. But hands are inches, not a function of centimeters. So,
yeah. Right. So,
yeah.
All right. So I said to Michael, all right, and I've dealt with these. So this is an internationalization issue, in my humble opinion. Or that's the direction I took here, and I kind of got it. Well, no, I got it, Dave. But there again was a lie here. So I said, if you go to System Preferences, Language and Region, and then you look at your region, my guess was that it was set to something other than United States. So that's one thing is on your Mac and also other major operating systems like Windows, you can indicate what part of the world that you're in. And, you know, good operating systems will tune the units, you know, your radix and, you know, units of measure to whatever's appropriate for your region.
Sure.
Now, the other thing is that, you know, he may want to dig a little further because you can also click on advanced and you will see a measurement units category. And at least in this case, there are two of them, U.S. and the other being metric. And I actually verified this on my system, Dave. I actually tried this. So I changed this, you know, so I was doing stuff in maps and I actually changed this on the fly. And I would see maps switch between miles and kilometers.
Sure.
And I was like, well, that must be it. And it was, but it wasn't. So Michael got back to me. Thank you. And noticed something really weird. So he said, John, hi, I checked the system preferences and they were already set correctly. And that both region and the measurement units were what he expected. So then he said, I changed them to Greece and metric, quit maps and the preferences, checked again, and the maps were still in metric measures. I went back, switched the preferences back to US, quit everything again, restarted my machine, opened maps, and it's now in miles. Thank you for your help. It worked, but I'm not sure why.
So
that's
like
why I'm saying
a corrupt preference entry, John.
Absolutely. So what he was seeing was, again, that's why I'm saying lies all around.
Yeah.
Is that the computer was lying to him about what units were actually being represented and that it said it was doing US, but it really wasn't. So he and, you know, I think you in a couple of shows ago, Dave, you made a recommendation for another problem that was the same sort of thing, is toggling a setting will perhaps get it into the right state. So toggling it to something else and then back to what it should be, which is what Michael did. And brilliant, Michael. I mean,
I think it's important to understand the underlying reason why we suggest that. And it's that the entire OS, all of your settings and preferences and all of that are saved in text files, and they might not be text files, but bear with me here. They might be binary plist files, but And what you see when you go and visit something in System Preferences or even in an Applications Preferences window, That is simply the computer reading the text file and doing its best to take the data that it's read in and represent it in this construct of a graphical of a window. And this window is constructed assuming that the data that it's going to read out of the preferences file matches one or more of a finite set of options. If that preferences file has anything different in it, the data that you're going to get in the preferences window is up for grabs. It's the assumption, and it's a fair assumption that most programmers are going to make, is I'm the only one messing with this file, so I'm never going to put anything in it that I don't expect to read out of it. And that's probably true. But if something else messes with that file, intentionally or not, or that file gets damaged, then you might have this situation where, like Michael did, where you see something in the UI, but it's really not reflective of the file. So what he did was he changed it to something else, rewrote the file, and then changed it back, which rewrote the file again. So whereas the user interface looked like two different things, we started with US, we switched to metric, then back to US. Really what happened is we started with something else that the computer said, it's US. Then we switched to metric, then we switched to US. So three different versions of the file for two different versions of the UI. Hopefully that makes sense. That's sort of the underlying reason why Michael did this and why we recommend this with preferences, especially in OS X. So, and it's true in iOS too, because iOS and OS X sort of deal with things the same way. So that's all right. I got. Yeah, good. You going to take us and to games? Go ahead.
Sure. But again, to condense it, Dave, lies. The computer was lying.
Right. That's right. Absolutely. No, it fits. I'm with you.
Why did it do this? Okay. James has a really good one here. All right. So, hey, well, he wrote to me, but he should have written to feedback@macgeekab.com.
Wait, did you say feedback@macgeekab.com?
I did, Dave, because I believe he wrote to me directly, which...
So he did not write to feedback@macgeekab.com. Well, while we're here, I want to let you know that that's the address to write to, because that goes to both John and I, unless, of course, you're a premium subscriber. And then, John, you can write to...
premium@macgeekab.com.
See how easy that is? It's totally simple. But you don't have to write. You could send an audio comment inside that thing. Like, you could attach it there. You could send screenshots. Or if you'd like, you could call us 206-666-GEEK, which John is
4335. And why are we doing this?
Tell them how else they can contact us, John.
Oh, we might as well do it here. Facebook.com/MacGeekGab is a way you can find out when the next show is going to happen. We have some discussion, and it's just a great place to be if you want your privacy invaded, right?
Sorry,
Facebook. Sorry,
that's
right. Guys.
Yeah. MacGeekGab.com/stream is where you can join us during the live show. When we record this, it's the same show. Those of you that don't join us for the stream for whatever reason, that's totally fine. You are by far the majority audience, but it is a pleasure to have a subset of you here with the stream. I'll say hi to everybody in the chat room. They helped us diagnose some interesting audio issues before the show, so you can thank them too. And then you can also find us on Twitter. Twitter.com/MacGeekGab gets you the show notes and any announcements about the show, plus some tips that we do share from time to time. We might get a tip in that's so good that we'll share it in the show, but we want to share it immediately with you too, and we share those on Twitter. So it's a nice little conversation we have. Of course, Twitter.com/John F. Braun is him. Twitter.com/Dave Hamilton is me. Pilot, Twitter.com/PilotPete's that guy that has been coming around more and more again lately. And of course, Twitter.com/MacObserver. And John, I think that does it. So take us back to James.
Wow. I'm glad you mixed it up here so we don't have to do that at the end.
Correct.
So anyway, so I forwarded it and, I replied. So again, please send the questions to the place that we sent here. Although you can understand why he'd want to send it to me and not you, Dave.
Okay.
No, just kidding. So All right. So James says, hello, John. I just started listening to Mac Observer or Mac Geek Gab a month ago, and he loves the show. I have a question about USB 3 ports and portable external hard drives. I have a 2 terabyte Western Digital USB 3 portable passport drive that doesn't use an AC adapter. It runs off USB for power. During large file transfers on my right USB 3 port on my Retina MacBook, OS X will randomly eject the drive. However, on the left USB port, this does not happen. Let me see if I can condense this here. Let me know.
I think that's good. I think you're fine. That's it.
All right.
That highlights the problem and allows you to share an answer.
Okay. So to summarize, yeah, he puts a drive in one port and it's happy, and he puts it in the other port and it gets ejected, and that's not right.
And near as he can tell, I mean, there's nothing else connected to those ports, John, or is there?
And that's a fantastic question. So number one, Dave, I did find, so I wrote back to him, but I am going to link. Again, you know how I love these Apple articles, because a lot of times there's somebody paying attention there.
Yeah.
So you have an article here. It's a HT4049. I'll put it in the room here.
All right.
Yeah, and I did not send this to him, so I hope he's listening. But anyway, so this article here in our chat room. So again, it's a HT4049. And what's the title? Apple Computers and Displays, Powering Peripherals Through USB. Wow, that sounds pretty timely. Now, the advice that I gave him, Dave, where to look, and the article kind of suggests this. So first I'm going to tell him, I'm going to tell you what I told him. Let me. All right. So to me, Dave, the best place to look to understand what your USB port or ports can do would be to click on the Apple menu, and you hold down the option key if you want the secret shortcut, and you'll see a system information choice. And then once you do that, running system information, you're going to see a hardware category. And then under hardware, there's going to be several things, and you want to click on USB. What you're going to see there on pretty much any Mac computer that has USB is you're going to see a whole bunch of entries titled USB bus or something similar. And if a device is connected to it, you're then going to see an entry for that device. For example, in my case, Dave, I have, you know, the MacBook Pro early 2008, and I see Bluetooth USB host controller, Apple internal keyboard trackpad, IR receiver, and built-in iSight under various buses. And if you click on a device, and to me, I think this is the important part. And if you click on a device, you're going to see two entries, current available and current required. All right. So quick electrical engineering lesson. What is current? Well, current is a measure that can be made of electrical circuit as to how much it can provide. And a quicker electrical engineering lesson. So current is measured in amps or milliamps. And that's typically, USB ports are typically provide power in either milliamps or amps. Amps times volts equals power, which is measured in watts. Now, the thing is, you can only, USB ports typically can only provide a certain amount of current. And the way USB works is that you have two things. The USB port itself knows how much current it should be able to provide. And then each device should report how much it needs. Now, again, the topic here is lies, lies, lies. Sometimes, and this is my suspicion, Dave, what's happening here is the device is not being totally honest about how much it needs. And that's why it's not working.
Ah, yeah. Interesting.
Okay.
Okay.
Now, the thing is also, well, what I suggested also that he wants to check out is look at this list, plug in your devices, and then look at the various entries here. And the article leads you down this path as well. But the thing is, I would suspect that there may be another device, an Apple or otherwise. Like I indicated, on my machine, there are several devices on the USB bus, Apple provided devices, whether it be a trackpad or an IR port or something like that. And I'm wondering if one port maybe has a device hanging on it that is drawing a certain amount of current and
inside the computer hanging on it.
Yes. And I won't know this until he collects the data here, because sure, I don't have this type of machine. I'm suspecting that one of the ports may have a device hanging on it where his drive is drawing enough current.
Yeah.
That, well, it's exceeding that. And that's why it drops off the bus, because the computer's like, get out of here. Or the drive's like, you're not giving me what I need. And sorry, I'm going to freak out and drop off the bus.
No, that makes sense. Because it's going to have one of the USB buses in the computer is going to have the keyboard on it. And one's going to have the trackpad and one's going to have the eyesight, right? The camera. And
right.
That's at least what you're going to see. And there might be others on that machine. I can't imagine what they would be off the top of my head. I don't think that machine has an IR receiver, but if it did, that would also be hanging off the bus, right? So these things are all just USB devices. They just happen to be baked inside of your computer, but it doesn't change the fact that they are USB devices and connect to your motherboard via the same USB chains that are available on one or the other ports on your machine. So, I think the lesson here, John, is if you find a port that works, stick with it or use AC power to power the device and don't rely on bus power if you need to use it from the other port.
Right. And now the article also says something very interesting. Now, the thing is, Dave, technically this should not be happening because Apple indicates that on their devices that have USB 1.1 or USB 2, which in my case, my MacBook is both of my machines are like this. Apple claims they offer up to, or they offer 500 milliamps at 5 volts on a USB port. And for the USB 3 machines, which this is one of them, they will provide 900 milliamps at 5 volts.
All right.
So their claim is that all of their ports should be providing the same amount of current measured in milliamps. And looking at my machine, now this is the thing. Why
but that's really never like been true, back. Right? I mean, we've been hearing about this for years, and it fits into your intuitive theme of the computer's lying to you.
Right. Now the other thing is the device could be lying because the thing is when you program a USB device, you're telling it, okay, tell the computer this is how much current I need. It may be lying. It may actually be drawing more. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, in that case, that gets a bit technical in this case. I mean, if you want to do this, but this gets into, you know, pretty heavy geek stuff here. You get yourself something called a multimeter and measure the current and see if the device is lying. Now, you got to be careful, though. Measuring current is something that you do in series and that you put it in series with the circuit here. And I don't know if I necessarily recommend that your average geek do this because you can blow things up if you don't do it right.
Right.
And I don't know if you grok what I said. I mean, measuring voltage is easy because you put it across two points here. Measuring current, you basically put it in line with the circuit here. And then the device, your multimeter, assuming that it can handle the amount of current.
Does Schrodinger's principle apply here that by measuring it, you're altering your own measurement?
A good multimeter should not do that.
Okay.
No, you put it in line and it should tell you the amount of current that's going through a circuit.
Because one thing I remember about measuring that is you can either measure the direction that it's going, the current is going, or the amount, but you cannot measure both, right?
Well, it'll tell you amps.
Right.
You know, how many amps are flowing at that point.
But I'm just saying general electric principles don't let you know you can't measure both the direction that the current is flowing. You're going to assume that the current you're measuring is flowing from the computer out to the drive, which because the drive doesn't have power is a very safe assumption. But like, for example, if you want to argue with your electric company, right, you could say that their meter measures the amount of current that passes through it. It cannot know which direction that current is going. Now, there's an assumption that it's coming from them to you, but if you're on your treadmill bike all day, pumping power back into the system, or you get your generator running, which is illegal to pump power back into the system, but if you did that, then it would actually rack up your bill if you started sending more current, you know, back across the line, which you're not supposed to do.
Well, I don't know if that's the... It has to be.
I mean, that's just general... Electric principles.
Well, all I'm going to say is in some cases, Dave, there are places where if you have solar panels or something else here, you can actually contribute power to the grid.
Right. But you get a different feed for that.
Right. Oh, okay. I see what you're saying.
You know what I mean? So, yeah. And that, right. And they do that. I mean, they do that, A, so that they can measure it right, but also B, so that when people are working on the lines, they know on this line, power is going to be coming back at us. So if, even if we disconnect it from the central switch, it might still be hot. And that's why you want to be careful when you plug it, you know, when you hook a generator up, that you do it the right way and you're not blowing up, you're not sending current back across the system. So, John,
I have one more thing, Dave.
Go ahead. Yeah.
To wrap this up. So it could be. So the thing is, technically, the USB ports, according to what Apple says here, should all be providing the same amount of current here. There could be a power management issue with the computer. And I believe in that case, I think the traditional procedure to address power issues on most Apple computers is, I believe, an SMB reset. Are you with me on that?
You said SMB?
I'm sorry, SMC.
SMC reset. Yes, yes. Yeah, you threw me off. I'm like, SMB, where are we now? I was thinking about the Heisenberg uncertainty principle.
Right,
and I got confused.
Sorry.
So,
well, yeah. SMB, of course, is the Windows networking protocol. Yeah, right. I'm sorry. I'm getting acronym scrambled here. But
SMC,
no.
You're totally right. Yeah.
So the SMC is the system management controller in pretty much any modern Mac computer here. And this is something... I think it's a chip or a circuit or something in the Mac. And it one of the things it does is it helps manage power, which, of course, this is one of those things. So it could be that something scrambled the computer and for whatever stupid reason, it's not managing the current through the ports properly. So an SMC reset can never hurt in this case. And maybe that'll fix the problem.
Yeah, no, the SMC reset could do it. That's right. Yeah, that you know, again, we've said it many times, when you have a problem that seems like a hardware problem, the SMC reset can often fix it without you needing to replace hardware. Not all the time. I mean, obviously, there's some hardware problems that are truly hardware problems, but a settings corruption in the SMC can cause what appear to be hardware problems. So there you go. All right. So, John, you know, we're speaking about not all power ports being equal, and those of us with various iOS devices have experienced.
What a nice lead in.
Hello. Yeah. Okay.
Brilliant. I'm sorry.
Thanks.
Go ahead.
Okay. No, have experienced this for a while. Right. You know, because the iPhones all require 5 watts. Right. Sorry. Am I getting that right? Yeah. 5 watts of power. One amp of power, right? And on over USB, sorry.
Current,
thank you. And I knew I had my words all scrambled. See, I'm still all scrambled up. And that's fine until, and works great to charge an iPhone at full speed. But if you have an iPad other than the original iPad mini, then you want a 10 watt power adapter, or even now a 12 watt power adapter, in order to charge those at full speed. And you'll see this when you, if you start charging from one that's not, that's only 5 watts, you will get if the screen is on, it will say not charging. And that's because there's not enough power coming in to power the device with the screen on and also charge it. But if you put the screen off, then it will charge, albeit very slowly. To confuse matters, and this does confuse me because I have not only some iOS devices here, but the Android devices that I've talked about, especially the Android tablets, they also need 10 watts of power. But here's the thing. If I plug one of those into my 12 watt or a 10 watt iPhone or iPad adapter, it only charges at slow speed. And conversely, if I plug my Android tablets into, if I plug my iOS devices into the Android charger, which all have just standard USB interfaces, they only charge at half speed. Why is this happening? Well, it's happening because this is slightly non-standard, and to do this and push more current across the USB interface, so the device, your Android or iOS tablet, and when I say iOS tablet, I mean iPad, handshakes with the power source and says, and there's like a little communication that happens, and the device needs to trust that what it's talking to is going to deliver what it expects and not blow it up. And so if it handshakes and says, yep, you're an Apple thing, I'm happy. And then it gets more. And the same is true for Android. So this has been a source of confusion for people. And also gets very interesting when you want to have like a multiple charger block that can do, you know, 5 on some ports and 10 or 12 on the other, you know, 1 amp versus 2.1 amps. It gets very confusing because sometimes you have to have ports that are marked differently. Well, a common thread at CES this year among some of the product manufacturers was solving this problem. So you can just have powered USB ports that you, you know, plug into the wall or are battery based ports that solve this problem and handshake magically with any device that you plug into them. And by far the most what seems to be, and I've used the products at least for the last week, is a company called Anker, A-N-K-E-R at I-A-N-K-E-R.com. Their products are, I'm going to say, the nicest built and also the sanest priced, because they have these things. They've come up with a technology that they call Power IQ, and that's their way of solving this handshaking issue and just sort of making it universal. But they're also priced really well. For example, there's this 5-port 40 watt wall charger, right? So it plugs into an AC outlet, and then it has it's got 5 ports on it, and you can plug anything you want into any of those 5 ports. They are all treated equally. It can push a maximum of 8 amps out of the device. So you could have, say, 3 tablets and 2 phones plugged in, right? If you try to plug 4 tablets in, one of them is going to get shortchanged, right? Because there's just not an, or if you plug 5 tablets in, 2 of them are going to get shortchanged because there's not enough, you know, in the 8 to hit 2.1 for everybody. But, and it's like $26 at Amazon is the thing. So that's for somebody that travels. This is an awesome solution because it, you know, you've got 5 ports, 1 outlet, and it's not a wall wart outlet. It's a standard plug, and it just it works. It's really, really handy. It's I used it in my hotel room all week, and I loved it. And it's well built and all that good stuff.
Nice. Because that's serious juice, man. Because as we discussed here, the thing is a lot of USB ports. Now, it's funny because if you review the article that I linked to, Dave, the thing is Apple makes some exceptions for their devices.
Yep.
If you connect to a USB port on an Apple computer and you have an iPhone or an iPad or something, it can request more juice. So they're kind of cheating. Whereas this device is a non... not platform specific.
Sure. Then, sure.
As far as I can tell here, I mean, an 8 amps, I mean, that's got the juice, man.
Oh yeah. That's oh, great. It does. Yeah. And so, and then they also have a series of battery packs that they offer. And some of these battery packs have multiple outlets on them. Some of them have one. I've got one that has one. It's a 6,000 milliamp hour. So that's enough to charge an iPhone. Correct me if I'm wrong, but about 3 times. It's about half a charge of an iPad, but it will, it'll push out full, you know, 2 amps of output if your device would take that. It's got the same kind of port on it, and that's $30 for a 6,000 milliamp hour. It's a really nice battery. It feels good in your hand. It's just one of those things that you don't mind holding, and it's good stuff. So, you know, after using it and talking to these guys at you know, Pepcom or Showstoppers, I can't remember which one, but one of those press events at CES, it's good stuff. Really, really smart. Good stuff. So that's one of the things I saw there at CES, John. And these,
cool.
These guys, you know, there were some people there with similar products. I wouldn't say they felt as well built, but, you know, they wanted like $60 for the double the price for the battery or whatever. And it's like, what do you see those other people over there that are doing this at the right price? So it's good. It's good.
Yeah. And I think, I don't want to get too, I want to mention this though here, because, you know, I think it's important that, you know, we try to explain to people these terms here. So we have current, which is measured in amps, as we talked about. We have voltage, which is measured in volts. And combining those two comes up with something called power, which is in watts. But there's also a measure that you touched on, Dave, called milliamp hours, which is another way of measuring the capacity of a battery. And I think that's just important because you touched on that. So typically, I think an iPhone battery, and if you think about this, I mean, you know, kind of explains itself. So if you say that a battery has 2000 milliamp hours, I believe that means that over the course of an hour, it will, you know, provide 2000 milliamps or 2 amps, right?
Sure. Right.
So the math is pretty. And I guess the other thing is, if you're talking about your power company, well, the power company does it a little different. I think most power companies measure what they give you in kilowatt hours, which is, again, kind of a similar measure. But to do the math here, and, you know, I think we should link to an article that talks about these. But the thing is that, you know, the relation between these things is fairly straightforward. So, again, voltage times power equals, or I'm sorry, voltage times amps equals watts.
There you go. Cool. All right, we got a couple other tips here too. In fact, we're going to let Jed. We'll let Jed take this one away. We love a tip like this. It's good.
Hey guys, this is Jed. Was just listening to episode 42 and heard all your great stuff about iTunes and iPhotos on multiple machines. And I kind of wanted to chip in with what I do. It requires Hazel. I think you could do folder actions or Automator, but I use Hazel. And I use Dropbox, but you don't need to. But for photos in particular, I don't like plugging in my phone. I don't like to sync it. Everything else is cloudy, so I just plug it in, and it's happy if I don't plug it into a computer. So what I have it do is I use the camera uploads feature of Dropbox, which puts everything in my Dropbox in the camera uploads folder. I then have Hazel copy that to the auto import folder of iPhoto. And then next time I open up iPhoto, I have all my photos. And it's great. It works great. I actually go a step further, and I have a folder in my Dropbox called For Import. And if I put a photo in there, if I put a song in there, if I put a movie in there, Hazel has a rule saying, hey, if it's a photo, throw it in auto import in the iPhoto. It has a rule that says, hey, if it's music, which is actually held on another different machine, take that, slip it into iTunes. If it's a movie over, you know, a certain size, put it in the movie folder. And it works really well. It's a great solution, I think, for multiple machines where things are going all over. And it's also really useful for when you get like an email with a picture and you don't want to open it on one machine or whatever. I just put it in the folder. I download it, I put it in that folder, and it works great. So that's just kind of my solution. If you have any questions, you can, cut me off, I guess.
All right, we will cut you off. Awesome. Excellent. I love Hazel. From noodlesoft.com. It is one of those things, being able to set these automated rules based on these kind of conditions is excellent. So Hazel, check it out. Not only does it allow you to do that sort of automation, but it will also watch when you delete things and offer to uninstall and just really kind of keep your Mac as organized as possible. So, yeah, we love Hazel.
I gotta check it out.
Dude,
I honestly have. I'm a simple man, Dave. You know this.
I know.
I got my tools that I like, but I know more than one of my colleagues, including you, like Hazel.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'll have to check it out.
Yeah. The cool part is once you kind of get it rolling, you sort of forget it's there until it stops, you know, until like you accidentally turn it off or whatever. And then it's like, what am I missing? So, yeah, no, that's great. Thanks, Jen. So I don't know where I found out about this next thing, John, but
we both found it. I found it within the last week. Someone mentioned it. And
it's called,
so go.
Yeah, it's called howsmyssl.com. And it will tell you they do their own test. And they will tell you whether the SSL support, security support in your browser, and yes, they really mean TLS, not SSL, but we all seem to say SSL. So that's what they report on. And they go through a series of tests with your browser, and then we'll come back and tell you whether things are good, bad, or, you know, questionable. And on the browser I'm on right now, John, which is Safari on my latest version of Safari. So Safari 6.1.1 on my Mountain Lion machine, because I haven't updated this to Mavericks yet. My SSL client is set, reports back as bad. So on Mavericks, it comes back as there's one thing that doesn't support session tickets. But Chrome and Firefox seem to report just dandy. So what is that? Are you seeing the same thing, John?
Wow, that's very interesting. So on my Mini, which is not running Mavericks,
right?
Yeah, I see a couple of bads.
Yeah.
Whereas running, and that's funny because as far as last I checked, I'm running the same version of Safari on both machines here, but it's running a different OS, right?
Right. Right.
Huh. So that's a good thing, because SSL, now called, of course, TL. Oh, wow. It even says here in big letters, your SSL client is bad.
Bad. That's right.
Yeah, the important thing is that SSL, you know, kind of ties into our discussion about certificates and all that stuff here, is that SSL, although it uses public key and certificates, underneath it all, it's doing, you know, the secret key thing. And if it's not done properly, as this kind of suggests, yeah, people could possibly compromise your network traffic. No, that's a good thing. Wow, that's really good.
I know. Yeah, yeah, it's good. And it's good because
bad.
It's,
well, it's bad because it says Safari and OS X is bad.
It goes through and
makes me sad.
It goes through and explains each of kind of the six general rules that or general sections that it goes through and grades you upon. So. So it'll tell you, you know, listen, we say that this is improvable or bad, and then they'll tell you why, and you can actually dig in and learn more. So, you know, good geeky stuff. All right. Moving right along. We will go to Rick, because this is an interesting one. Rick pointed out, and we shared this on Twitter too. I think we shared this on Twitter. I'm pretty sure I did.
Matt Geekab did. And
yeah.
I have some commentary here, but hit it off.
So he pointed us to an article that shows how to access a semi-hidden setting or utility in Mavericks to get more Wi-Fi diagnostics than we've ever seen before. So the path is this, and it's important that you follow every direction, because I did not. I saw the picture on the article and said, oh, I know how to get there. And then I couldn't get there. So you hold down the option key and click on your Wi-Fi icon in the menu bar. That's step one. Step two is at the very bottom. Now that you have done this option click at the very bottom, it says open wireless diagnostics. It will ask you for your admin password, but enter that because you'll need it. But then stop there. It wants to walk you through this whole thing. There's a splash screen that shows up, and it's going to want to walk you through this test. And if you do it, then it'll say, yeah, everything's great. And then you're done. You don't get the information that we're looking for. At that point where that splash screen comes up, go to the Windows menu and choose Utilities. And then select. And so now you're going to come up with this thing that has five tabs: Info, Frame Capture, Logging, Wi-Fi Scan, and Performance. And you can spend quite a bit of time digging around in here, because it's got this frame capture thing, has sort of a Wireshark like thing where it can show you what data is being sent across your Wi-Fi interface, which can be really handy for diagnosing things. But the Wi-Fi scan, so the fourth tab that shows up, is the one that will scan everything. It will come up with your it'll sense what channels are being used around that computer. It won't necessarily sense your whole network, but it will sense what's happening around the location of that computer, neighbors' networks, your multiple networks, etc., and then come up with a recommendation saying, here's what we believe are the best 2.4 gigahertz channels and what we believe are the best 5 gigahertz channels to use. And I believe that's similar logic to what the airport base stations will use if you put them on auto channel mode. So it's an interesting thing. So you may or may not agree with its channel choices. And I think that's where my friend, Mr. Braun here, is going to chime in, but I'm curious, John. Go.
Well, no, I, That's exactly what I was going to say. And actually, a few people that I've interacted with on the Twitters and otherwise, I don't know if they violently disagreed, but they indicated a concern that the channel recommendations, and I actually had a concern as well, Dave. So I ran this utility in my environment.
Yep.
And it said, yeah, you know what? I think you should be on channel 2 or 3. And I'm like, at least a 2.4 gigahertz
right.
channel 2 or 3.
Right.
And as we've discussed, Dave, for 2.4 gigahertz Wi-Fi, the non-overlapping channels are 1, 6, and 11, correct?
Correct. That's right.
So having, so I got to, I want to understand their logic in looking at my environment, where I looked at my environment, Dave, and pretty much everybody surrounding me is either on 1, 6, or 11 at various, you know, single strengths and all that.
Yeah.
And I'm just scratching my head as to why they told me I should be on 2 or 3.
Well, if you have my guess is that if you have people around you on 1 and on 6 and on 11, then it's got to go with a second best. Right. And so they're going to try and squeeze you in between the channels that exist. And so you don't you're right. You want to be on 1 or 6 or 11. But if there's contention on those channels, then you can find sort of second best peaks happening between those channels. So that's going to be around channel 3 and around channel 8. And that's probably why it's telling us this.
All right. I'll try it. The again, based on what I know, you know, picking these in between channels is.
Well, listen, here's the deal. So at 1, 6, and 11 are no, because I think we're going to confuse people. There's nothing inherently wrong with picking any channel, and that includes 2 or 3.
Right. They're all valid channels.
If you are in a vacuum. Right. And mm-hmm. there are no a wireless vacuum and there are no other wireless networks available. Any channel you pick will ostensibly perform the same. There might be some, you know, arguments that higher channels or lower channels perform slightly better. But in general, every channel is going to perform the same if there's nothing, if there's no contention. But to limit contention, we say we know that channel 1 will kind of take up, you know, space 3 channels lower and 3 channels higher as it because it's sort of, you know, think of 1 as the peak, the apex of the channel, and then things mm-hmm. sort of slope in and out from there. And so knowing that, we know that channel 1 kind of spills up to almost channel 3, and then channel 6 starts a little after channel 3 and goes up and, you know, spills down to channel 9, and then channel 11 spills up, etc., from 9 and goes past it. So if you can, if let's say your neighbors are on 6 and 1, you want to go to 11. But if your neighbors happen to be on channel 8 for whatever reason, then channel 3 is awesome because that moves you, you know, we're moving the apex around. So here's the thing. If you've got contention on 1 and on 6 and on 11, there are gaps happening at about 3 and about 8. Now, they are not full gaps, but they are as good as it's going to get. So if you've got massive traffic happening on 1, 6, and 11, 3 and 8 are better for you than trying to, you know, join in on 1, 6, or 11 with other traffic. So I'm not convinced that this is a bad thing. You want to okay. look, you know, I think it's important.
Well,
to, you can run
well,
something.
I'll try
like,
it.
Yeah. I would run iStumbler as well. Right. Because iStumbler gives you a visual representation of who's where and what their power levels are. And so you can kind of say, well, yeah, there are people on 1, 6, and 11, but the people on 1 are kind of far away. So I can probably use 1 and be fine because that's, you know, not going to interfere. But if the power is equal across the board, then I would choose 3 or 8. It's again, it's non-optimal, but you're also making it non-optimal for your neighbors when you do that. Right. I mean, it's you're just dealing with the problem. So,
right. Well, that's where I see is that, you know, it just, you know, cascades into just, you know, Wi-Fi wars in the neighborhood and then just nobody's happy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everybody stay on 1, 6, or 11. Just cut it out. Don't go to these.
Well, but again,
channels.
If you've got.
I get it. No, you know, I get it.
Four networks around you. It's better to slide in the gap, even if the gap isn't quite sure. as wide as you would want it to be. Right. You're picking the second best. So
sure. What I'm saying is that by you doing that, then you then further traumatize the other networks, and then they may do, you know what
correct.
I'm saying? It just kind of snowballs. So
it does. Yep.
But no, I'd love to see their algorithm. No, I'll have to look at, like you said, something like iStumbler, look at who's around me, their channels, their relative signal strength, and the noise levels, and see if what they're saying makes sense. It just struck me as odd because, you know, normally it's not something most people would recommend that you choose these odd channels.
But right. Hey. Right. No, I would recommend the odd channels if okay. everything else is saturated. Of course. Of course. It's a gap. It's not a perfect gap, but it's not a mm-hmm. perfect scenario for anybody. All right. So, you know, before we wrap up here, John, I wanted to talk about a couple of the other things that, that I saw at CES this year. There was some cool stuff. One thing
I certainly hope so.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing that I saw was from our friends at Buffalo, and they have a travel router, which it's interesting. They, you know, it's a 2.4 or 5 gigahertz travel router. And the best part about this thing is it's tiny. It fits literally in the palm of your hand. It is 2 inches square. It's got an Ethernet port on it.
Wow.
Yeah. And you power it via USB if you want. And then it has a switch on it, and you can go 5 gigahertz or 2.4. They recommend that, you know, if you're just in a hotel room, you use 5 because you don't need the range of 2.4. And you probably have a whole lot less contention, as we just mentioned. So that's one thing that I found very interesting there at CES. And the best part is it's not out yet. It's called the AirStation AC433. It's going to be out very, very soon. The MSRP on it's going to be $60, and they expect that you'll be able to buy them all day long at Amazon for $50. So $50 for a travel router that you configure once, and then it just works everywhere that you go. So that was one of the things that I really liked.
Nice. So again, it's a N or G or N. I would.
It's
assume,
N
right?
N. Actually, no. It's AC. 802.11ac.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, that's impressive.
For, uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which,
I know.
In theory, could get you up to.
It will go
a gigabit.
It will go
right?
433 because it is single.
Oh, okay.
It's one by one.
Oh, single band or single channel.
Yeah, it's 433 on the 5 gigahertz, and then 150. Huh. So it's N on the 2.4, and then AC on the 433. But you can't use both radios simultaneously. It's one or the other with a toggle switch on the unit itself. So
okay.
It's pretty cool.
So a good option to maybe like a Airport Express. It sounds
yeah.
like.
Less money and much smaller. So, yeah, I mean, it's good. You know, it's the kind of stuff I like to see. So, so that was one thing. Another thing was this just blew me away. I put a video up and I'll link to it. They, one of the 3D or it's a company called 3D Systems, and they were demoing a 3D printer technology, but this, I mean, this was amazing. They had actually printed musical instruments and had a live band playing in their booth. And I took some video of it. So I'll put that up. It's amazing. I mean, they had drums that were drums, and the dude was playing them, but they had a whole to make it visually interesting. Everything had weird patterns in it. So the drum shells actually had a lot of holes in them, a lot of holes in them. So the sound of it was not the sound of the shells. It was more the sound of the heads, but that's just me being a drum geek pointing that out. The drum, they held their shape. They were tunable, you know, all of that stuff, which is pretty cool. And the bass was the same thing. This bass had like a carving of the New York City skyline in it. And it was printed as one thing. They put the pattern in and the whole thing printed out. So so check that video out. It's you know, it was pretty certainly fit into cool stuff found, at least for me. So, you know, I like that kind of stuff when I see it at CES.
Nice. The 3D printing. Did you see? Now, I saw a report of this. And, you know, like I told you, I went to some prior events and the cost of these are dropping like a rock.
Yeah.
Did you see the XYZ printing 3D printer?
No, I didn't see that one. But
so there's an article here. So anyway, so just a quick plug here because it caught my eye.
Yeah.
This is a $499 3D printer.
That's cool.
$499 US.
That's cool, man.
Now, it may not be the fastest or the best, but wow. I mean, $500, dude. I mean, that's, you know, that's what you pay for a regular printer.
We paid more than that for our laser printers when we first bought them.
Yes, we did. Yeah. We paid probably twice that.
I think so. Yeah. I know.
I don't know what I'm going to 3D print yet, but I don't think I'd do drums or something like that. But
right. Yeah. It was pretty cool. So the other thing I saw, John, and I just wanted to kind of round out the show with this. Last year at CES in the television realm, everybody was showing off their prototype. Everybody, you know, Panasonic, LG and Samsung were showing off their prototypes of curved screens. And I saw them and everybody said, oh, yeah, it makes it more immersive because the edges aren't out of focus for you when you look at them, you know, as they would be if you're looking at just a flat screen. Like, OK, fine. You know, and the screen is curved toward the edges of the screen are curved toward you. Not much. It's not it's not like a crazy angle, but it's, you know, enough that they say that this makes a difference. And I said, yeah, whatever. Because on a trade show floor, it's really hard to know, right? I'm not in my living room. There's fluorescent lights and a zillion people around. It's like, yeah, whatever. It looks cool. You know, great. This year, they all have their curved TVs in their model lineups. So they're going to be selling these things. You might be able to buy them right now. But at least one company, LG, had a flexible TV. Now, this isn't like a flexible screen that you'd roll up and put in your pocket. But it is a flexible TV that with their remote control, you can change the TV from perfectly flat to curved and back. Now, curved on this, I think it was a 70-inch TV. They had, again, it's hard to tell scale on the show floor, but the edges of it moved maybe 5 inches from flat to fully curved and back. And you could set it anywhere in between. And their whole concept was, if you're watching the game and you've got, you know, 15 people in your house, you flatten it out so that you get good viewing angles from everywhere. But if you just, you know, snuggled up with your sweetie on the couch and you're watching a movie, you can curve it in and, you know, get that, you know, more in focus, more immersive experience. That may or may not be true. But what I found was it gave me the ability to A/B on the spot at, you know, on the show floor. And it's about an 8-second process to curve this screen with the remote. As soon as they went from flat to curved, I was immediately sold. Everything they were saying last year about the curved screens feeling more immersive and all of that is 100% true. It's really cool. So I did not buy into the concept. I thought it was more, and it may wind up being a thing like 3D where it's like, you know, cool, but not enough widespread use case to matter, but it definitely matters whether it's enough to justify going and getting a new TV or not. Meh, I don't know, but it's not just a bunch of marketing hooey. I experienced it with my own eyes. That's because that's what I use to look at the TV. Yeah,
I would hope so.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you, though, the other thing that came up here, Dave, and, you know, the thing is, I have an HD TV, though. It's a 720p.
Sure.
Which is technically HD. Correct. So now they got the 4K or Ultra HD, and there's a minor difference between the two, but I think we'll call them the same thing.
Yes.
But from what I understand, that was a big thing, too. Now, I don't know if I'm, again, entirely sold on that. I mean, I'm still trying to upgrade my stuff to Blu-ray and HD, and now they're introducing more HD. It's like, I don't know about you. I mean, I from what I understand, you're happy with your, you know, you got a plasma, which, you know, seems to be dying a horrible death, right?
We actually just bought a new plasma. We upgraded from a 42 in the living room to a 60 because I'm really happy with Panasonic's plasmas, and they don't have them. They are done with plasma in their 24.
That's what I heard. I heard they discontinued them.
Yeah. So for that reason, I wanted to get one before they discontinued them. I'm very happy with Plasma. I like the consistency you get out of it. Whereas with LED, you know, if you're moving up and down, you get weird angles, and we sometimes watch on the floor and sometimes watch up on the couch. Yeah. So I figured I'd go Plasma. And actually, as it turns out, CNET's reviewers agreed. They said, don't let Panasonic's exit from the Plasma business deter you. In fact, run out and buy a TV if you like Plasma, because these are some of the best. So that's what we're doing.
Yeah, I think I still have a, I think it's a Samsung, one of the first generation. I think it's a 720p, I think it's a CFL backlight.
Yep.
But it's pretty. Works for me.
Yeah, hey. It depends on your room. The 42 worked great for us when we were kind of using...
Well, you saw, my room's small. Yeah. My room is small, so a 42-inch 720p is fine.
Yeah, and it was fine for us until we reconfigured our living room and kind of have things going the long way, and then it was still fine. Don't get me wrong, but it was like, yeah. So.
All right, so you want to do that thing, Dave? I hope you taped it, but you want to watch Helix.
Helix. All right.
Sci-fi.
All right.
Put it in the TiVo. It's the latest thing from sci-fi. I believe the executive producer from Battlestar Galactica did it. It's, it has to do with, check it out. It's on sci-fi. It looks, it could be a Fringe replacement. We'll see.
Really?
Huh? Yeah, it's kind of sci-fi. There's conspiracy, government things. There's, weird contagions and diseases and all that fun stuff. I mean, it's just monkeys. They got monkeys. I mean, who doesn't love monkeys, right?
Sure. We love monkeys.
I like rats better, but...
Well, you know.
Or an African gray. Hey.
I don't see it on my... I just tried searching for it in the TiVo app, and...
I had problems too. Okay. I searched under HD and I didn't find it, but if I search, Helix.
Yeah, it doesn't come up. I mean, it comes up, really? But it doesn't seem to show up as an option for me to record. I'll have to mess with it more later. Now's really the wrong time for me to be messing with my television, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so the thing is, we don't have to tell people about,
Oh, we've already taken care of that. I think
we talked about feedback at MacEGab.com, so we don't have to talk about it again.
We don't. No, that's right. And now we've gone one over because we've said it four times. No,
I apologize.
It's okay. It's okay. All right. I think that's that. We are here next weekend. John, I got to look at my schedule, but I think the afternoon slot next weekend is going to be the one. But we'll be recording on Sunday. It's I think the afternoon slot. I might have updated our schedule. I don't know. I don't know what to do about the following weekend, though, because I'm going to be in San Francisco for the Mac 30th party. And if you are anywhere near the Bay Area, I know they haven't been pushing this a whole lot, but that's not because it's not going to be awesome. Ridley Scott's going to be there to speak. The original Mac design team are going to be there. I know Dan Kottke is involved. Dan was Steve Jobs' roommate when he went off to India and all that stuff and up at Reed College. I'm trying to think of who else is going to be there. I think Mike Markola is going to speak. Yeah. Yeah.
He's like the dude.
I know.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Have we met him before? He's been to our
I've never met Mike, to my knowledge.
I know we've had some Mac luminaries. Like, I believe, who played with the band one time? Who played keyboards, right?
Oh, yeah. Bud Tribble.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. He played keys with us at one gig. Yeah. He's a great guy, too. He's super smart. Bud's the dude that's his team. I mean, it's not just Bud. His team is responsible for all the cool... he might kill me for saying this. I don't think so. He's high enough up there that he's okay. Nobody's going to fire him. They're the ones doing all the great Mavericks, like power management and memory compression and all of that stuff is Bud's team. He's super smart. He's headed he's VP of software engineering or something at Apple. But yeah.
All I got to say is, Bud, thank you. That to me, dude, that stuff is...
magic.
As a techie, that is some of the most brilliant stuff in Mavericks.
I agree.
All this behind-the-scenes stuff that does things that you need, but you don't know that you need, but you really do. No, I love it. I mean, the power management alone, I'm like, I just love the detail they put in that.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Yeah. So anyway, so there's going to be a ton of people there. It's at the Flint Center, which is where the Mac was originally introduced 30 years ago. It's on January 25th. You can buy tickets on Ticketmaster, and I will be there. The Macworld All-Star Band is capping off the evening with a, you know, short little half-hour set or whatever, so you get to see the All-Stars as well. But really, I'm stoked to play at it. Don't get me wrong, and I'm really honored to be a part of it. But my big excitement is just about being at it. So definitely, if you're nearby or if you just want to fly out. That's what I'm doing, and come join us. So, all right. I do want to make sure I thank we thank Michael Johnston from the We Have Communicators podcast and GetAppLure.com. I got to see Michael while I was in Vegas. He was en route moving from Illinois to California. And he passed through Vegas, just so happens, while I was there. So
really?
Yeah, he and I got to hang out, and I got to meet
wow, what a move.
Madeline. And yeah, I know. Yeah, I was so excited. It really reminds me of when Lisa and I kind of just picked up and moved down to Texas. It's cool to see them kind of doing this together, so I'm stoked for them. But so thank you, Michael. Visit GetAppler.com if you would, please. And also go listen to Michael's podcast, We Have Communicators. It's a great show about iOS and all that good stuff. The CacheFly folks are awesome, too. CacheFly.com. They provide all the bandwidth that gets the show from us to you. And they had a booth at New Media Expo and were doing cool caricatures. They had a guy doing caricatures on an iPad. And
yours was pretty darn accurate.
I thought so. Yeah.
I think it caught the best of your mm-hmm. visage.
I know. I thought he did a great job. So I might actually have that guy at Cirque du Mac too. But we'll see about that.
That would
he's from the Bay Area.
That would
Area.
Be awesome. Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
That would be an awesome addition to the.
I know.
That would be totally in the Cirque spirit.
Yep. I agree.
We have all sorts of other artists. Yeah, yep. I think that'd be outstanding.
Yep. So I gotta get with him about that, but we'll see. So that's further off, you know. We'll get there when we get there. Of course, the podcast marketplace includes BB Edit from Barebone Software and Yojimbo from Barebone Software, Gazelle, as I mentioned earlier in the show, to sell all your stuff, Text Expander, PDF Pen, the whole PDF Pen suite from Smile, Squarespace, of course, and of course, Transporter through Connected Data, filetransporter.com. Alternate Backbeat Media Podcast Network. I know. It's good stuff.
Now, Dave, what did you learn during your travels to CES and all that? I hope you can give us something here.
Well, you know, I learned that proper planning is the recipe for success. And really, I mean, we know that because it falls under the umbrella that we like to say, don't get caught.
Made up.